Okay, this is Bob Dobbs, and it's Friday, June 10th, 2016, and I'm talking to Cameron McEwen, and it's a good reason to talk to him, and we're going to go into his blog and all the work he's done, and I don't know if anybody else knows about it. So, Cameron, beginning with your blog called McEwen's New Sciences. And if you want anybody wants to go to it, it's McEwen's without an apostrophe S, McEwen'sNewSciences.com. And there's an archive so you can look up titles. And I'm taking a particular blog. Is that what you call it, Cameron, a blog? Is this a blog?
Yeah.
Right. And it's called Mistaking McEwen, but there's a hyphen between miss and taking. So it's Mistaking McEwen Overview. He's got a few others, Mistaking McEwen 1, Mistaking McEwen 2, which takes on Arthur Croker. So you open up saying, and this is, it's not the first column you wrote, is it? The first blog in
no.
this series.
Oh, it may be the first blog in that. I'm sorry, when you say the first blog in the series, you mean first?
No, the first column, the first item.
No.
Yeah, but it's done early, it looks like, but it's not the first one, but it's important what it says. You say, although interest in McEwen's work has certainly revived in the last decade or two, and this was written maybe, let's see, down the bottom, posted January 10th, 2014. Is that about when it was written?
Yeah, it'd be over 2 years ago.
Right, January 10th, 2014 is posted, and you wrote it just before then. So it says, although interest in McEwen's work has certainly revived in the last decade or two, investigation of it remains fundamentally limited by debilitating mistakes. These will be examined here in a series of Mistaking McEwen posts, which will look at the ways particular scholars have distorted, often violently, what he was up to. The next paragraph, certain obvious failures appear over and over again. For example, little McEwen scholarship is bothered to read, let alone consider, all or even most of his astonishing output. Even highly influential readings of McEwen, like that of James Carey, are based on superficial acquaintance with only a few of his texts. This sort of shoddy scholarship is especially surprising where it frequently leads to the charge that McEwen's scholarship was shoddy. Great sentence there. That's right. They all said he was a shoddy scholar. They don't do anything close to what he did. So let's see if the next paragraph... Yes, you say, the third paragraph, more fundamentally, all existing McEwen scholarship examines his work in what he termed the rearview mirror. I'm not going to read the next part. Okay. So, Cameron, we know each other a little bit. You know of me here and there. So I think we met at Mark Stallman's loft on West 20th Street about 1998, 1999. Do you remember that?
Yes, sir.
Had you finished your negotiations with Mady Molinaro and whoever else was involved over digitizing McEwen with George Sanderson? Had that come to an end at that point?
That's a good question, but I don't remember. I think that I think it was still... I don't want to say an open question, an open hope.
My memory of it was it didn't look good, but it wasn't finished or it wasn't definite that it was done, that it wasn't going to happen.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what I mean by an open hope.
Yeah. And it was gone by 2000. It was not going to happen by 2000, right?
I think it just sort of, the possibility just gradually petered out, and eventually the McEwen family gave all of the rights to Ginkgo.
Oh yeah, and that's the early that might even be 2000. We could look up when they started. They put the first books out. We can look up the dates there. We know that's probably a year before that, right? Because it takes a year for them to get organized and then start publishing thing. So, okay, that's the clue. Go to Ginkgo Press, see when it started, right?
Yeah.
So, anyways, we talked. We had a good conversation there. And then I didn't talk to you again for many years, and then eventually I knew you were doing this blog, and I didn't have a chance to read it 1 or 2 years ago when you drew my awareness to it. But I started reading it the last couple of weeks, and I'm very impressed. It's amazing. And in the sense that I think you know that I can't be accused of not reading much of McLuhan. Is that how we say it? I've read a lot of McLuhan is what I'm saying, and I think you know that.
Sure, more than nearly anyone else, I would say.
Yes, I'm up there. Now, the one person who maybe did more than all of us is Gerald O'Grady. Do you know him?
I don't know of him, but I've listened to a couple of his lectures online and read a couple essays, so I certainly know of him.
Right. Well, he, in like 96, 97, lived in Ottawa for 2 years just to go through the archives, Marshall McLuhan's archives, for 2 years.
Right.
And he Xeroxed it all. He got copies of it all, which is incredible. He also found video in the warehouse nearby, some other warehouse. So he has an amazing collection. And I actually offered to buy it from him because apparently he's in his 80s. He's not healthy. I don't know if he's leaving us soon or not. But he said no, he wasn't going to sell it. But it would be incredible to get it because I've made different offers to get it myself up there. But you have to go through Michael McLuhan, and he won't let you have half of it. So it's a big headache. So I haven't been able to get everything. But I did get a lot in the late 80s, early 90s when it was first available. And then I also had a pretty good collection. So what is really great for me reading your blog is you took the time to take my favorite quotes, and there are many of them, and go into this obscure part of Marshall's work, the stages of apprehension or the drama of cognition, and begin with that, which is really important. One can read that around page 30 to 32 in Interior Landscape. You can see McLuhan's essays on Joyce where he spells that out, about his theory of apprehension, cognition. So what's incredible is that you've typed a lot of this great stuff from obscure articles people don't even know about. And that reminds me, how did you find these articles? What have you been doing? How did you get location, that article, 1962 and Location? Location magazine.
I think it's pretty easy. I mean, you just work out from existing bibliographies.
But did you have to go somewhere? Did you go to libraries to get it?
No. I mean, sometimes I have to use interlibrary loan.
Oh, okay.
To get certain articles. I found most of the stuff is surprisingly easily available, but the... It's just a sad fact about McLuhan scholarship that even stuff that's lying on the surface isn't bothered with.
Right, right.
It's actually typical of Canadian scholarship about Canadians.
Is that right?
It's not just McLuhan.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay, so I just posted, I don't know if you're tracking my, I don't think you're on my Facebook page, but I just found a recording of Arella Gagnon, who was a young programmer at CKLN in Toronto in the middle 80s at Ryerson's college station. And I was on there then, and she got a chance to interview John Cage in person in the studio. And so she knew my interest in Cage and McLuhan, so I get on the phone, and I'm part of the interview. But as a result of talking on the air with him, he got me Location magazine. He got me the article because it was put out by the gang around him, the Fluxus gang, I think, and that's the one who published it. So he had access to it, so he sent it to me. So that's pretty neat. So anyways, here you are quoting from Location. I mean, no one else even knows about it unless they've studied the bibliography that Mark Stewart put together, you know, really rigorously and noticed all these things. And what I did in the late 70s was walk around Toronto. I'd move there, I mean, I had access to all the libraries all over the city, and I eventually found a good chunk, you know, 70% of everything there, including going to microfilm. But how long have you been doing this collecting?
Well, one thing to keep in mind, Bob, is that I'm in my day work, you could say. I'm a digital publisher.
Okay.
Right. Our company, Intellex, is attempting to publish the complete works of all of the great figures of the tradition, from Plato until Wittgenstein.
Right.
And we have most of this stuff online already. And so I'm professionally involved in obtaining texts, digitizing them, and getting them online. So it's much less sort of work for me than for somebody like yourself.
Right.
I don't have to type anything. I know how to do this without any typing.
Right, and so that's how you review your knowledge of Plato or Nietzsche. You have access to the texts through your job.
Well, yes. Well, I certainly have access to the texts, but it's not just a question of having access to the texts. You need to have some kind of background dealing with them.
Yeah.
Nobody can open a page of Plato and understand it in a single reading. Somebody like Plato is somebody that you can hope to understand some small percentage of over a lifetime.
Yeah, yeah. So did you do philosophy in college, university?
Yes. Yes.
All right. So you've been thinking about McLuhan and Plato for 40 years, say.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. More. Yeah. I would. With McLuhan, it hasn't been a question of thinking about him constantly for 40 or 50 years. I've just gone through different periods of interest with him, and the blog over the past, say, 3 years. Just represents a kind of strategic gambit where I've come to the awareness that McLuhan represents a kind of access, or may represent a certain access to ideas that have been developed in Canada by a whole range of figures, but in a way that Canadians and then the world at large really know nothing about.
Right, right. Yeah, we're going to get into that. So so the next logical question is, you told me you met McLuhan, proposed a program for, I guess, your master's or PhD with him around 1970, 72 or
yes,
something.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
What was the idea that he rejected that you presented to him?
The idea that I proposed to him and that plays a big part in the blog is that McLuhan's work has importance only if it is ontological, that is to say, only if it represents a way of dealing with reality.
And that's ontology? Is that what ontology deals
yes.
with?
Yes.
As opposed to epistemology, what's that, knowledge of reality? What's the difference between being, I associate the word being with ontology. Explain to me the difference between ontology and epistemology.
Okay, so the in Greek, the word for being in somebody like Plato is to, which is the on, O-N.
Okay.
And with Christianity, as you can see in icons of Christ, the article is changed from to, which is the neutral article, to o, which is the masculine article. So icons of Christ invariably label him in the halo behind him as O-on. So the Christ is being, right?
Right.
So
that's
ontology.
Wait a minute, Cameron. You said it's the letter O, space, and then O-on. That's what's behind
him.
Okay, O-on. All right.
Okay, so he's labeled as being. So, in other words, the Christian conception of the Godhead is that the Godhead is being with a big B, and then Christ as a man is the representation, or is the coming into small B being that remains in relation to big B being.
Right.
But that's just an aside to the idea that ontology is traditionally, Christian or not Christian, the science of being, the science of all that there is.
And so some people so some people in modern terms would say it's about reality, all of reality. What is
Correct.
Reality?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and then epistemology?
The epistemology is the science of episteme, which is knowing, which is understanding. So you could say that ontology is is the study of the widest possible reality, objective and subjective, and epistemology is more the understanding of the the subjective reality from humans. So the study of awareness, you could say.
Right. So then in using McLuhan's terms, is being, is ontology about percept, and epistemology is concept?
No, you couldn't say that. Both percept and concept are epistemological.
Yeah, it sounded like when you said it, you said the knowing sounded like percept, the way you defined episteme. So, yeah, they correlate. They're interchangeable.
Correct.
Which
Correct.
Is the core point of so much of what you write, this interchangeability, which literacy frustrates the awareness of it, you know, originally,
Correct.
I guess. Yeah. Yeah, and that's a really important point. So, so my question was, how did I get into that, ontology and epistemology? Don't know how, what. Do you remember what I said to get you saying that? What was my question?
You would ask me, what was it that I proposed to McLuhan?
Oh, yeah.
And then I got into this idea that what I proposed to him around 1970, I think it was 71, which is an idea I got interested in again just a few years ago. So after a space of almost 50 years, I proposed to him that if his thinking were to have a future, he needed to show that it had an ontological anchor, that it was not something merely strategic. And then I tried to say, and I think that this relates to your Catholicism.
Yeah.
And I believe he was put off by the fact that I wanted to bring Catholicism into systematic connection with his work. I get the impression that he always tried to keep those apart.
Yes.
And then I believe he also felt that the what I was proposing was too theoretical, too conceptual, and that I was
you're in the wrong department. He's advocating
maybe
media studies, and he didn't see that as conceptual. Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So when he rejected it, does that mean you have to come up with something that he accepts? Does that mean you have to go to another department?
No, our gardeners are just coming around now, so I'm going to be moving around a little to get away from their noise. If I start to fade out or something, let me know.
Okay.
It wasn't a question of him rejecting my thoughts. He basically didn't respond to them in a way that I thought he understood them, number one. And number two, the life of the carriage house at the time just didn't interest me. It wasn't very engaging, wasn't very serious, actually, in my estimation.
Right.
These are judgments that I now regret. I think I would have been better to have put them aside and worked with him.
Right.
But at any rate, it was from my side that I decided not to stay there.
Yes. So if you had decided to stay there, would he would not accept your proposal. You would have to come up with something that he would accept. If he didn't, then you have to go to another PH director? Is that what happens?
Yeah, normally. Of course, different people have different ways of relating to their students, and different institutions have different rules. Normally, if you were going into a graduate program for the first time, as I would have done then, you don't come with a thesis idea. That's something that evolves over time.
Mm. So you were too much of an upstart for him, and you were not even in the right topic, right area of study. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I think what I was proposing was not something that he found interesting and that he found suspicious, I think.
Okay, so then what you're laying out in this blog is the issue that you wanted to deal with him 50 years ago.
Yes.
Wow.
That's right.
This is your saying, well, you're not around, Marshall. I'm going to do it. I'm going to write it out anyways, is what you're doing. And you're finding you can make a case with his own words.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not a question of trying to get revenge on Lewin. Remember, there's many ways in which communication can be attempted. So if you go to some Zen monasteries in Japan, then the communication begins with rejection. And the candidate is only qualified when they have come to terms with rejection.
Right.
My whole concept of communication, which I think McLuhan in his better days had great insight into, is that communication isn't linear, isn't something that just gets plugged into your rearview mirror. Communication is something that happens through adjustment, through some kind of
Agon?
Spark.
A-G-O-N? A-G-O-N? Agon?
Sure.
Yeah.
You can say that, yeah.
Yeah.
And, that's Greek for struggle.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, according to Plato, Reality itself is an agon.
Right. And that's a key point you're making that you see McLuhan understands. That's the dram of cognition.
I think that's true, yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay, so what was my next point? So what's remarkable is that you go back to the 40s and 50s and find these articles and then take choice quotes. And it's what I always thought about, those quotes, the drama of cognition. You can hear it on my radio show going back in the 80s. People would be talking about something. They call in, and I'd say, well, that's the drama of cognition. And there was no takers on it. You're the first person to go into it. Now, Don Thiel used to – Don could talk about it. And he said that up to the 90s, Arthur Croker's essay sort of touched on the drama of cognition, and Thomas Aquinas, you talk about that, 1984. Not the digital – is it digital humanism? Is that part of the book, Innes, Grant, and McLuhan? Or is that a later essay? I think it is in the book, right? Digital humanism by Croker?
I think it is the McLuhan chapter, yeah.
Yeah. And so, yes, he talks about – he touches on a little bit of the key things to understand about McLuhan if you're going to take his – Thomism or what he said in his early articles. Seriously, you've got to work it out, which you've done. And there's been some people have touched on things, but they don't go into it in depth the way you do. And then you're also showing how it's a constant theme. You're of the school that Marshall didn't learn anything in his agon. He just maintained the way to do the agon and maybe changed the clothing of it, the ring he got into. But you're seeing he started early, he knew what the issues were, and he stuck with that. And he didn't, quote, learn anything later or change that.
Well, I wouldn't say he didn't learn anything. Just as a point of method here in our conversation,
yeah.
when we're talking about McLuhan's work, We're talking at the same time about how work is done in general by anybody, and especially by anybody that's thinking, anybody that's worth talking about.
Yeah.
So it can often be the case that you have somebody like McLuhan who has a series of ideas, and they're not necessarily his own ideas, right? McLuhan picked up many ideas from other people that he kind of internalized.
Yes.
But it can often happen with thinkers that around in their early 20s, you can find many, many things that they are still talking about in their 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't be true to say that they didn't learn anything, because any great idea needs to be lived with and teased and argued with for decades before anything is understood about it.
Right. So then he changed his understanding of it, or he got deeper understanding of it, and that may not be change, right, but it could be called change. He refined his understanding of the original questions. That's what you're saying?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And, you know, that great phrase, I said it to you the other day, the dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions is what you talk about. You might even use that phrase at some point in your blog, but that is a great summation of figure-ground relationship in the study of a great question, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
But I didn't see that quotation. To me, that's very interesting, but I don't remember you sending that to me.
No, I quoted to you the other day on the phone.
Oh, I see, okay.
And you liked it.
Yeah.
So you don't know where it is. It is, if you go to the little yellow book, McLuhan Hot and Cool, with Gerald Stern, have you got a copy of that?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, around 107, 109, it's either in the paperback or the hardback. I think they're a bit different. But approximately,
right,
if you have the paperback around 107, 109, at the top of the page, you'll see the statement. It's excerpted from Explorations, I think. There's a series
mm-hmm.
of dark fonted statements. That's where it is if you want to look it up. Okay.
Sure.
So, all right. So, I found, so your blog, I would say, and you seem to be aware of it, is the first time anybody is really taking on McLuhan, having read a huge amount of it, figuring out what the issues are, and then laying it out. And I don't know if anybody else has done that. Do you? Nobody's doing what you have done.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think you're right. It's not that I would put it this way. It's not that I'm doing more work, although I may have. I don't take a point of view on that. But if my blog has value, it's because it tries to read McLuhan's work in a context that makes that work important.
Yeah.
Most work on McLuhan trivializes it.
Yes, they don't recognize the depth of what he did. They sort of, they know it's, he's important, but they haven't figured out what it is that's important. So they talk themselves into a corner.
Like, yeah, but their whole notion of what is important is flawed.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And it,
yeah, go ahead.
No, it's okay. I was...
No, no, say the next sentence. No, what's the next sentence? Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I said before that McLuhan's, and I even said this to McLuhan himself, that it was very important for his work not to be taken instrumentally, right? As
yeah.
Some expression of a need for power.
Right, and also Don Thiel criticized Tom Wolfe for taking too much of a neurophysiological approach to McLuhan. Brain research. Is that what you're saying also? You would agree with Thiel there?
Well, I would agree that plugging McLuhan into some category of the rearview mirror is mistaken. I mean, right. I take your critique of Wolf that you made at that New York conference.
Yes.
I take that to be right on.
Yeah.
Basically, you said, look, you're taking too restricted a view of McLuhan and...
Teilhard de Chardin.
De Chardin.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I'm glad you appreciated that. He didn't want to deal with it. He made a funny remark. He said, well, there you have it. And he wouldn't address it.
Correct. Well, he knew that you knew 100 times more about McLuhan than he did, and he didn't want to expose them.
Yes, yeah. He was in the question period. I noticed, looking at it again the other day, a bit hesitant. He was like over his head. He was a bit insecure, it seemed, at least at parts of the question period. Did you notice that? Do you recall that?
Yeah, I think that's true. Sure. Well,
yeah.
He should have been insecure. He didn't know much about McLuhan.
That's right. Okay, so... is there a McLuhan scholar? I know you would like me. You get something out of all the scholars, but who's one that you appreciate? Sort of came the closest to what you thought was a good contribution. Do you have any favorite?
No.
But
no,
you
I
look.
Not,
you look at the model.
My, it's not just McLuhan. My advice in regard to anybody, I mean Plato or Aristotle, and coming forward, is to read the original text and to pay as little attention as possible to secondary literature.
Mm. And that's what you're doing. Now, you do read other people's books on McLuhan. You may not have read them all, but you've read a lot of them.
Yeah, too many, I would say. But, my strategy there is to try to show what McLuhan was talking about by making a critique based on McLuhan's work of work about him.
Yes, yeah. Okay, so then about the there aren't many people who've read as much as you and I have on McLuhan. Andrew Crystal's read a lot, and he was there at the archives, and he read a lot of the letters, and he has a lot of probably pretty good notes, as well as whatever he copied. But to Gerald O'Grady at the McLuhan Conference, the Legacy of McLuhan, in March, end of March, or March 28th or so, 1998, he, because of the schedule, he only got like 5 minutes to speak. He didn't have very long to speak. But he pointed out that, now he said, I've just spent a couple of years at the archives. He didn't go into the details that he had lived there for 2 years, but he said, I spent there. And he said, if you read all of McLuhan like I did, there is nobody you can say influenced him. And all that we're saying today, and he'd been at the end of the day of the two-day conference, is all that we're saying is really puny. It's none of you are dealing with McLuhan, and you're putting these little, you know, donkey tail categories on him. It does not work with McLuhan. And I thought that was a great statement. I agree with that.
I think that's true, but partly it reflects an overuse of the word influence.
Yes.
That infects academia. Influence is a very, very vague thing. In regards to McLuhan, if you were to take away things that he got from Richards or Gideon or Gilson or
Lewis,
Innes, et cetera, there wouldn't be a hell of a lot left. Right? It's not the case that McLuhan didn't have very, very important relations with a whole series of people. But what you can't do is read a couple essays by one guy and a couple essays by McLuhan and then write about the influence of the quote-unquote influence of one upon the other.
Yeah.
That's just trivial. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I think that's what O'Grady was criticizing. There were a lot of speakers. There were about 45 topics, 45 speakers, and I guess he noticed that everybody was trying to say what influenced McLuhan, and he got fed up with that and decided to speak and address.
And I agree with you that that's important to note, and that was good that he said that.
Yeah. Okay. So. If we take the idea that Marshall writes about Gilson, Lewis, everybody that he writes about, his unique response to them is saying, you guys are all responding to the electronic environment. You are a knee-jerk response. You're not seeing through the effect. You're making discoveries in the sciences, in the humanities. You're making intellectual breakthroughs. You know, structuralism starts looking at language and linguistics. You're only looking at language because you're inside a new kind of language, the electric language. And so he was writing an inventory of the inspirations caused by the electric media. Now, that statement, it's relatively accurate, right? Wait a minute. You would say it's accurate, but then you would bring your degree of analysis that you bring to it with the gap and everything, and then your unique vocabulary. You would break it apart, what I just said, right?
Yes.
And I know that. But on that, what level is it when I point out that McLuhan is saying everything we discovered in the 20th century, it was due to the ground of electric characteristics, tactility extended? What's the limitation of me saying that? What's wrong with that? What's limited about it?
Well, it's easy to take a number of those terms as if we understand them very well.
Okay.
Right? So electric environment, for example.
Yeah.
So somebody can say, well, we have electric lights, and now we have electric cars, and we have computers, and all that stuff. So that's the electric environment, and people are walking around in this environment, or they're dreaming in this environment, or whatever, and that's why they have these thoughts.
Right.
The problem is that doesn't get us anywhere. That's all that that might give us indications for further research, but it doesn't do much more. So what I try to do is I try to leave aside those kinds of pronouncements and get to the probing or the experimentation or the analysis that is going to get into possibilities that can actually lead to prediction and communication.
Okay, so that's my next point. You talk about prediction. What do you think of what he said in Playboy, and he had said it in other areas here and there, the media, you get a position, and then you look at the environments, and you treat them like a global thermostat. So you increase the radio in Venezuela because they're too heated up by newspapers. So maybe you cool them off with television. Do you take that kind of statement seriously, or is that put on?
No, I take it very seriously, but I'm just going to close the door here because of the gardener.
Yeah, I heard him.
McLuhan was talking, when was that, 1969 or something?
It came out March 69, but he was talking, and the interview was in through 68, and I understand that Eric Norden couldn't understand McLuhan, so eventually McLuhan wrote out the answers.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
So what McLuhan was saying in 1968 is close to what was reported in that press conference in 1964 that we were talking about
yes.
the other day. It was reported in the Globe and Mail and the Star and maybe the Telegram. So McLuhan is saying this is like 60 years ago almost.
Yeah.
He's saying that there are ways of using the media that can achieve mass control.
Right.
And so he gives examples of a thermostat and controlling the economy and all this sort of stuff. Now, he is existing in the present of the 1960s, but he's reading out of that present something that has become fairly obvious only now.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So his the vocabulary that he had at his disposal and the conceptual means of trying to conceptual means of what he was trying to indicate, but the conceptual handle on what would actually be going on, of course, that had the disadvantage of operating in what might be called prophetic mode, right? He wasn't
yes.
talking about something that, some machine that existed at the time where you would push a button and then it would happen. He was talking about a possibility that existed at the time, but that would not be realized for 50 or 60 years in the future.
Right.
So, of course, the way in which he said it, and the you might say the kind of prediction he made is a little screwy, but that was being screwy was the only way it could be done.
It was all he had to work with.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So
yeah, go ahead.
Well, I mean, to me, it's exactly that sort of thing that makes his thinking great. That we know that he had a handle on something because things that he said at the time, which were taken to be crazy, right? The idea that you could control an economy like a thermostat for decades was taken to be a sign of his stupidity or
yeah.
his insanity or whatever. And then now that all of the people that made fun of it are gradually dying off, People are saying, you can control the economy of countries through the mass media.
Yeah, that's what Bernanke and whoever the present guy is, they admit that. Yeah, Yellen. They go to Davos every year and say, nothing works. We've got to come up with a new kind of level. We've got to think out of the box. And they get close to McLuhan. That's what they say at these conferences, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But they don't know how to implement it. They don't know, which brings to the idea of the collective consciousness. But before I go into that, have you had anybody comment on your blog? I noticed at one point, one topic, Mark Stallman made a comment maybe about Nietzsche or something. But has anybody, I've just started to read it, and I've only read about 20 of them. Has anybody commented on your blog? Entered into a dialogue with you?
A very few people, a handful, that's it.
Any of the known McLuhan scholars from the Media Ecology Association?
No.
Just people who are friends of yours.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Andrew might have made a couple comments.
Yes.
But I don't think McLuhan scholars aren't interested in it. Most McLuhan research is it's controlled by maybe 20 people or something that enables them to travel around the world and be McLuhan experts.
Right.
And they're just as uninterested as Tom Wolfe was in actually probing what they take to be their knowledge of, or what they sell as their knowledge of McLuhan.
Right. The I got some personal anecdotes about that. I'm pretty sure Derek de Kerckhoff told me back in the 90s that he had not really said anything about McLuhan since 1986. Now, lately, the last couple of years, people seem to have to talk about McLuhan on a little more take-it-seriously level. Even Croker had a little press conference about McLuhan in a way that he didn't before. So what most scholarship is people going around reading a little McLuhan and trying to decide whether the guy's worth studying or not. That's as far as they get. They might make a conclusion.
Well, but we should differentiate between worth studying as if we mean studying in a deep sense, or if we mean worth studying in the sense that people give you money to, talk about him superficially.
Yeah,
all of McLuhan scholarship thinks he's worth studying in the latter sense. That's how they... they get their salaries and their pensions and their benefits and their travel grants.
And you find when you read their output, it's appallingly superficial.
Right.
That's what you're saying. Yeah.
Correct.
Well, I felt that myself. I even on a level, 20, 30 years ago, why isn't anybody quoting early McLuhan or quoting the Dram of Cognition and the kind of things that you quote? Why isn't... As a matter of fact, that's what McLuhan's response to Jonathan Miller's book. He says he has nothing about my literary criticism in there. He doesn't go in to take it seriously what he did in the 40s and 50s. And McLuhan considered that important, and Miller excluded that, made a couple of categories and said he was a Southern dupe or something, and then didn't go into it. So I knew McLuhan, he knew that what he had laid out and what you can read in the book Interior Landscape, that you're not a serious McLuhan scholar unless you deal with that, what he laid out before 1962, before he beg your pardon?
Yeah, that's true, especially because in my take, 1960 is the watershed with McLuhan. That's when he has his first big stroke.
Yep.
The last rites are administered, according to Carpenter, the whole nature of McLuhan's thought and bearing changed at that juncture.
Yeah, and do you remember Carpenter says that McLuhan said to him, basically he wished he died because he had finished his work.
Correct.
You know, well, what? Correct. Oh, wow, what did he do back in the 50s? Well, got to start. You got to read Cameron's blog to find out some inkling of what he did. Because you or anybody, you, the listener, is not going to go look up these articles, you know, but you've laid out here. And that's why I now can take a lot of these my favorite quotes, and you have a lot of stuff that I've forgotten, but then I read them. Oh, yeah, I remember that. That's good. I can fling these around now. You know, I can Johnny Appleseed with so many quotes that you've provided. I'm doing that on one Facebook page, a Marshall McLuhan Facebook page already. It's incredible what you've done for someone who wants to spread the actual quotes that nobody knows McLuhan said, you know?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so, all right, so I'm going to bring up my notes about particular parts. That's what my general opening questions were. What kind of response? How did you get into it? Oh, yeah, one more. When you met with Mark and I in 98, I remember you making a big deal about chemistry, and I don't know if I understood why you were saying it was such a pivotal a landing spot for humanity 200 years ago. Could you replay? Because I see you using it. How did you get this insight, and what is it, in brief, about the importance of chemistry and why it, you know, removes alchemy from any serious level investigation of matter? Could you go into that?
Sure. But it's in my latest posts, I try to talk a lot about physics and about theory of relativity.
Yeah.
The way I get into that is I use a passage from Valéry that he wrote in 1932, where he's talking about Einsteinian physics, and he says that he compares it to a geometry of geometries. And he says that what was happening with Einstein was that can be seen if you take a piece of rubber and you draw a triangle on it, and you have a geometry that can be built from the triangle that's on that piece of rubber. Then if you twist the rubber, another geometry is possible from the triangle that's on the twisted rubber. Or if you stretch it, there's another geometry. And so he says what Einstein was doing was he was trying to take all the possible geometries and show what remained constant in them. And what I try to do is I try to say that McLuhan was doing that sort of thing for experience, for human experience.
Right, that's the dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions.
Sure, that's certainly one way of putting it, sure.
Yeah, the twisting, setting up different proportions.
Right. So then if you think of the chemical elements, those are different proportions between electrons, neutrons, and protons.
Yeah.
That's all they are. Chemistry rests on a table of proportions.
Yes.
Okay. So what I try to show is that in order to take McLuhan seriously, you need to have a way of, our gardeners are on both sides of the house trying to hunker down in the middle where I'm at an optimum distance from both. Is that real?
Yeah, but yeah. I'm not hearing them. You're okay.
Oh, okay. Good. Oh, fine. They don't bother me. I thought they would be distorting
no.
your reception. So,
no.
Okay, so let me just, I'll...
So McLuhan takes the element, what is done in chemistry, he makes the new elements, the fundamental electron, proton, neutron particles, the media. Isn't that your point?
But, Yes, but if let's say that we call the medium can be called the atomic structure of experience.
Yes.
And the reason that the medium can be called the atomic structure of experience is that all experience, in McLuhan's terms, can be analyzed in terms of a dynamic relationship between the visual and the acoustic. And that dynamic relationship is controlled by what he calls tactility.
Yes, that's the in-between, so, the in-between of
correct.
The two archetypes. Yeah.
Absolutely. So as I have a post that I did a couple of weeks ago called From the Visual to the Visual, but the second visual is in quotation marks. And what's all important in my view in McLuhan is to understand that visuality and the acoustic and especially tactility are not things that we can understand from our ordinary experience.
Would you? How about this quote? This quote, the end of Hot and Cool. He's asked, "Will there ever be silence?" And he says, "Objects are unobservable. Only the relationships between objects are observable." When you say we don't understand the eye or the ear, we don't understand. We can't define the object. You have to involve relationality to make a definition. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, partly.
Yeah.
But there's another very important consideration. When Einstein is talking about space and time, he's talking about space and time technically as space and time as variables that can be used to rigorously define different spatial possibilities.
Wouldn't that be efficient causality, material causality, and maybe final causality, but not formal causality? That's what Einstein he's working.
I'm not. I sort of understand what you're saying, but I'm not. I don't think it's helpful in that context to bring in Aristotle. It's not that there aren't interesting questions involved there, but they're very, very complicated.
Okay, so back to what you were, if we don't include that.
Yeah, so space and time, if you look out the window, if Einstein looks out the window, he's looking into space. If he looks at his watch, he's trying to know what time it is. But when he's talking about space and time in his work, he's not talking about what he sees looking out the window or what he sees on his wrist. These are technical terms, and they can only be understood proportionately, as you were saying.
Yes.
And that's the same thing with the senses in McLuhan. The senses in McLuhan are not what we ordinarily think of with what we see or what we hear or what we touch.
Right.
It's the reverse of that. We have to understand our experience, namely what we see, what we hear, what we touch, in terms of this technical vocabulary.
Yeah, now in one of Don's books on McLuhan, he lays out the six meanings of the word sense, S-E-N-S-E. That's what you're getting at. There's six levels of sense. I mean, sometimes McLuhan will say the word wits instead of extensions of our senses, extensions of our wits. So that makes it multi-level, which is what you're always stressing anyway. But that's what you're getting at here, that he's talking about the senses in a multi-level meaning.
Yes, but even more than that, that he's attempting to articulate what it means to be human, what it means to have experience in terms that work no matter how you twist the rubber.
Is this what you mean when you say plural? You'll write a line and then you go, plural. Is that what you're getting at right here, plural?
Absolutely. when I do that, especially with time or experience or something, I'm trying to indicate that there's a lot going on in these words, and until they're allowed to be plural, and until their plurality is allowed to raise questions in our minds, then we aren't understanding what's going on.
Right. Now, Barry Nevitt, have you ever read any of Barry Nevitt's books, ABC of Prophecy, Keeping Ahead of Economics?
I have, not for years.
I just wanted to bring up a point. He talks about McLuhan developing an epistemology of experience. But you
right.
might include that, but you're saying an ontology of experience.
Well, I'm saying that it turns out that if you have only epistemology, you have nothing.
Right.
So
you have to include ontology.
Yes. Yeah, so what happens with Nietzsche is that the whole tradition of epistemology being a clue to ontology dies.
Yeah.
Nietzsche shows that epistemology by itself leads to nothing, namely nihilism. And for me, that's a very, very important thing that and that's one of the things I tried to talk to McLuhan about, because I had that idea even then, although I probably was not able to articulate it very well, and I certainly didn't know all that much about it, but I had done my thesis on Nietzsche and on his nihilism, and when I read McLuhan, then I had a kind of standard against which alone he would either make sense or not make sense.
You mean against Nietzsche? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, against the Nietzsche gives us a critique which somebody either falls under and dissolves, or they have something interesting to say.
Right. So one night in a Monday night seminar, he was talking to somebody, and I was just eavesdropping, and he made a positive statement. It seemed to me in my memory, like, yes, Nietzsche studied the effects of media. Would you agree with that, if that's what he said? Is that understanding? Is that giving too much to Nietzsche, more than one would expect? Because remember in the
'40s,
he writes a letter to Ong or somebody saying, Catholic Church a little off the beam about Nietzsche. We need to look at Nietzsche a little more, or something like that. You remember that?
Yeah, I remember the letter.
Is he doing what you just said? You've used McLuhan to bounce off Nietzsche, or Nietzsche off to McLuhan. I wasn't sure exactly what he said, but those little instances that I just said are indication of what you're pointing to, that McLuhan had to deal with Nietzsche. He found a way to, you know, put him in a box or something and remove him, but he had to be responded to. Is that what you're saying, as you contrast McLuhan and Nietzsche, or whatever that sentence was that you said about 2 minutes ago?
Well, what I was saying is that Nietzsche's critique gives us a standard which other thinkers either are able to deal with or not. And McLuhan knew this standard, not necessarily from Nietzsche, but interestingly enough, Eric Havelock, in 1950, in a book called The Intellectual Crucifixion of Man, set out at some length Nietzsche's argument. So I don't know myself that McLuhan knew a great deal about Nietzsche or read a great deal about Nietzsche, but I know that he knew Nietzsche's argument, and I know that he knew that if thought was going to be worthwhile, it had to be thought that was not immediately destructed by that argument.
Right. So, and you think he did come up with a way to respond to Nietzsche?
Sure.
Yeah. Now, what about his statement in Explorations, maybe Verbi Vocal Visual Explorations, that Wittgenstein comes up to the edge, stares in the abyss, but doesn't leap? You remember that statement?
Vaguely.
Okay.
I haven't thought about it in a long time, but it's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
One thing we have to understand, McLuhan, like any great thinker, or like any decent thinker, I should say, I don't know that he was a great thinker, but McLuhan was able just to take a smell of people. And so he talks about Heidegger, he talks about Hegel, he talks about Nietzsche, he talks about Plato. Didn't necessarily study any of these people in depth.
Right.
He was more like an artist who used these people as colors that he could then sort of dab on the canvas.
Yeah, and he said he wrote surrealistic canvases. That's true. He said that.
Yeah. So I don't think that we go to McLuhan in order to understand Wittgenstein or Heidegger or Hegel or any
right.
of these people better. I think what we do is we read McLuhan as if he were a thinker of this kind of rank, and that we do him justice only by posing to him the sorts of questions that thinkers of that rank deal with.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And then
yes.
as Canadians, we have a kind of obligation. We need to show that Canadian thinkers have not just been country bumpkins, which is pretty much what Canadians think Canadian
yeah.
thinkers to be.
Right.
Perhaps even more important, we with Innes and particularly with McLuhan, we have somebody who invented techniques for communicating thought that are unique, right? I mean,
yeah.
Plato has been around for 2,500 years, and people have read him and studied him, all this sort of stuff. And the world's in ever-increasing worse shape. So Plato might be 100 times greater thinker than McLuhan, but he never figured out how to communicate what it was that he was thinking about in a way that had practical application for the world.
Right.
So maybe McLuhan did just that.
Yes.
Right. So McLuhan is, we can say, is he doesn't deserve as much space in the library as Plato should have, but space in the library isn't the big question. The big question is, what the hell are we going to do?
Yeah. And McLuhan is out there preventing people burning down the libraries or justifying coming up with a reason why they shouldn't be burnt down. Or advocating them being burnt down. You always take 2.2 levels there, or include the opposite. So in your writings. Okay, so why don't we go into then your discovery, unless Jim Patterson was part of it, but you are the one, Don Thiel coined the phrase the Toronto School of Communication. Derek DeKirchhoff gives some obscure guy, Jack Goody or somebody back in the book of 1968, said something about the Toronto guys, but I think it was more the essay in 86 or so in Croker's Journal where Thiel names the Toronto School of Communication. You have come up with and produce a lot of proof for it of the Winnipeg School of Communication, correct?
Well, yeah, but the term itself comes from Jim in Toronto. It's not my term. What I think I've been able to do is to show that the term is not merely one of irony. It's one of real substance.
Right. Now, you include, is it Rupert Lodge, Henry somebody, and someone else? I don't have the names exactly
right
here.
I say there's two generations in the McLuhan School of, in the Winnipeg School of Communications. In the first generation, there's Rupert Lodge and Henry Wright, which were two philosophy professors that happened to come together to University of Manitoba in 1920. When I say came together, I don't mean they came from the same place or on the same train or something. I just mean that they happened to come at the same time. They became co-heads of the philosophy department, which in those days included psychology, and then they taught many courses in common. So it was not unusual at all for a philosophy course in those years, and those years lasted for three decades. It was not unusual for a philosophy course to begin with a semester taught by Wright, which would be have a lot of psychology, and then go over to Lodge that would be more philosophy.
Mm. And what was the third guy? Henry Carr? Somebody named Carr? Or?
No, you're thinking of Father Henry Carr, but he's part of the of St. Michael's. He was president of St. Michael's. And
The Gilson world. Etienne Gilson.
Yeah, exactly. Carr was the guy that got Gilson to come to Toronto.
Yeah, now who's the third guy out in Winnipeg with Lodge and Wright?
No, it's not, there's actually six people, and they divided into two generations. So you have Lodge and Wright in the first generation, and then you have four people in the second generation. The first of these was S.I. Hayakawa,
yeah,
who was at the University of Manitoba just before McLuhan came there, and interestingly, who after he went to McGill for his master's, he went to University of Wisconsin for his PhD, and he was at University of Wisconsin up until 1935, and then again from 1937 to 39, and the 1 year that McLuhan was at the University of Wisconsin was in between there.
Yes.
So I don't know that they met, but I know that there was considerable influence on what Hayakawa was doing on McLuhan.
Right.
So Hayakawa is the first figure in the second generation. Then you have McLuhan, and then you have W.O. Mitchell, who is a Canadian novelist, who is at University of Manitoba the same time as McLuhan. And then you have Goffman, Irving Goffman with an E, who was there in the, began in 1939. So that's 5 years after McLuhan left. But I suspect that all of these people were greatly influenced by
Lodge and Wright.
Wright.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about Lodge and Wright is that they were representatives of the sort of neo-Hegelian school that is known to have very great influence on a whole variety of Canadian scholars, but is not known to have influenced people like McLuhan, but it did.
Right, right.
And they basically taught that all experience comes in fundamentally different varieties, and that when you're reading philosophy or reading people in psychology, you always have to first figure out where they're coming from. And all
what
of
their
these
biases,
later
you mean?
People,
what their bias?
Pardon me?
What their bias?
Yeah,
is?
You can say that. What the bias is? Absolutely. Yeah. So all of the four later people all take up a variety of stances in regards to this question of where are you coming from.
Right. I remember it startled me or struck something in me talking about somebody, maybe Tom Wolfe with George and McLuhan. It's more George. When you bring up someone like Tom Wolfe, they go, well, he's from the South. They would go into the biographical particulars of the person. You know what I mean? That's how they classified people. It wasn't his ideas, but he brought some baggies with him. He was understandable if you knew where he's from and what that area's tradition was. Is that what you're getting at? That's the classification thing they got from Lodge and Wright?
Right, but you see, these questions are inherently self-referential, and that introduces a problematic to them. Because if you say where it's important to ask where somebody is coming from, the person that poses that question is also coming from somewhere. Right? And so you get this House of Mirrors effect. Right?
Yeah.
And this is one of the reasons why McLuhan either has an ontology or he's not interesting.
Yeah.
Because if he were only to say that I'm doing stuff like Alice Behind the Looking Glass, where I'm talking about where people are coming from in ways that just go on and on and on and on, then that's not very interesting because it just peters out. It doesn't lead anywhere.
Right.
Right. So Wright and Lodge were sophisticated people, and they realized that there were, in order to show that you knew what you were talking about if you were asking about where people are coming from, you had to show that your classification was more than passing,
yes,
if you can put it that way. So if somebody like Wolf says, well, this is, that guy is from the South, or that guy is from the North, or whatever, that's really not a very interesting classification because all sorts of people come from the South. Right?
Yeah.
And that's exactly, if we go back to your earlier question about what's my critique if we talk about the electric environment. Well, if you just walk out on the street in front of your house right now, presumably everybody's walking around in the electric environment, but their opinions and their points of view, their perspectives are all completely different.
Yeah.
So unless there is a way of saying where people are coming from and how they're being influenced, then it's not interesting. It's not specific.
Okay. I remember Corinne, like she would say, Corinne McLuhan, she'd go, well, he's a bookman. These categories too. Like they were like media / anthropologists, and they would look at what medium the person used, and she and Marcia would classify it that way. Well, he's a book man. Uh-huh. Anyways, is it accurate to say that kind of classification, and maybe in the broader sense you just tried to define, is what Rupert and Lodge and Wright were doing? What is it that
absolutely?
You, okay,
absolutely.
Right.
And as I said, they. Ultimately, they had it through Hegel. And Hegel is a really interesting figure in terms of the agon that we were talking about earlier, because like Plato, Hegel says that the fundamental agon behind all experience and behind all reality is threefold, and that that threefold is always operative. And what's key there is that you have a very complicated notion of time that in my reading, at least, McLuhan picks up through Lodge and Wright, and that ultimately goes back to people like Hegel and Plato. And this is the idea that although history unfolds in some sort of linear fashion, what is going on in that linear unfolding is not linear at all. It's has to do with structures that are always operative.
Yeah.
Right? And so you, there's a kind of intersection of times going on here. One time being linear and one time being vertical or synchronic, and that the locus of thought is at the juncture of these times.
Yeah. Now, in his introduction to, I think, Empire and Communications, reprint 1972, he opens by saying that Hegel started to intuit ground and called it existence, I think, but it was looked at conceptually. Do you recall that
right.
statement?
Only vaguely. I haven't read that in some time. But
would you agree with me that Hegel started to see ground, he called it the Zeitgeist or whatever, and saw there was something molding people, doing something to people, but he went at it conceptually because it was that print book era, and McLuhan redoes Hegel perceptually. Would you go with that?
Well, I don't know if it's in that context, but in another, but in some context, he says that what Hegel was doing was reintroducing the acoustic.
Yes.
Right. So I think when you're talking about the conceptual there, you may be talking about how McLuhan saw Hegel reception,
right,
rather than what he thought Hegel himself was doing.
Well, that would fit into the second Copernican revolution, McLuhan's category for Kant. Kant discovered inner space, which starts to get into acoustic space, which is what McLuhan said the Romantic poets, the first wave of symbolist poets, were rediscovering acoustic space, and that's all the same period then.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So you have, to my way of thinking here, you have McLuhan looking at a problem that is literally perennial, that we have known about at least since Heraclitus, and it may be possible to go back double the time since Heraclitus to the Egyptians and the Old Kingdom. Some of their mythology already brings up the problem of trying to understand how peace and conflict are to be understood together.
Dude.
Right. So, this problem gets translated for McLuhan into terms of the visual and the acoustic, and how they're either at peace or at war. And he sees this problem sort of developing through history, and he realizes that he needs to rethink it. Not because the thinking has been bad, but because it somehow hasn't clicked.
Right.
And so he's looking for the click of this deep thinking that's always been going on.
Right.
And,
now, yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, you start to say, and, you know, I don't want to stop your complete sentence, so what would you have added?
Oh, I guess I would have just said that goes back to what we were saying before.
Okay. Right. So when Carpenter says in, I think it's called Thinking Through Language, something he wrote for Explorations in the 50s, he says the Eskimo doesn't have the idea of why. They don't have that sense of causality. Is it innocent McLuhan's discovery that writing, going back to the Egyptians, caused these questions between motion and absolute illness or something, all these paradoxes or divisions, is it caused by writing even before?
Well, remember that at least in my reading of McLuhan, it's very, very important to problematize all of these terms.
Yeah.
So that I say, when McLuhan's talking about writing, he's not talking about what you do at a desk or what you do on a computer or something. He's talking about writing in a technical way, just like Einstein talks about space or time in a technical way. And so in order to understand what he's talking about with writing, we have to understand a kind of system of thought that attempts to set out a kind of focus and then asks us to try out that focus to see if it can make sense of things that we haven't been able to make sense of before.
Right. So how is mentioning writing talking technically? I'm not sure what the content of that when you're saying he's talking technically.
Well, for example, if you go out, I mentioned before, if you walk out of your house and you talk to the people on the street, they're going to have all sorts of different opinions.
Yeah.
The structure of their thought and perception is going to be different. And so to say, well, all of that comes from the electric environment or something isn't very helpful, because there's a disconnect between the variety that's there and the singularity of the electric environment. So then if we say writing caused this, the problem is some people would say, well, it really wasn't writing yet. That only happened with the Greeks.
Yeah.
And then you could, if you look at what Egyptians were thinking about and talking about in terms of their mythology and the different commercial writings and stuff we have from the time, is this stuff all the same or is it different? And if it's different, you know, how does the causality work between writing, which seems to be singular, and this difference of concern? I mean, it's like pouring water into the desert. It doesn't get us anywhere. It's not as if we can take statements like that and help to orient ourselves.
Well, but the paradox is that McLuhan did sound like he was saying that. The 60s turbulence was due to television or the satellite. He seemed to be saying they were a new level of causation that humans couldn't see until the rapid production of technology environments and environments in the 20th century, leading to a kind of collective consciousness. So there is...
That's right. I agree with you. He did talk like that. And as I think you've often quoted Eliot when he says, I got to use words to talk to you, right?
Yeah, I was going to quote about two times already in our last hour and a half of talking.
So partly McLuhan had to use words.
Yeah.
Partly he had to talk to people that didn't have background and understanding that he had. He had to teach.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Partly he had to think through himself these ideas that he had, because he didn't have these ideas are not things that you think to the end and then you have them like a package. They're like a funnel where you're starting at the thin end and you're going ever further into the wide end, and there is no end.
Yeah.
Right? So there's many, many reasons why McLuhan would talk like that. And then we also mentioned that his 1960 stroke, which I think made his mind less flexible and made him tire more easily, which may have played an influence in how he was talking.
Yeah.
So all of these are considerations that we need to bring to bear, and then we need to say, well, what about all of the techniques for analysis that have been evolved over the years since, say, Heraclitus? So, for at least 2,500 years, humans have been thinking about these kinds of problems with very great sophistication. And if we want to say that McLuhan is worth thinking about in this context, then we can't withhold that sophistication from our reading of him or our listening to him. So all of these factors need to be brought to bear on when he says stuff like that.
Right. And you're explaining why he says in Annie Hall to the professor, you think my whole fallacy is wrong. That's a very accurate McLuhan statement based on what you're saying and blogging. Him referring to his work as a fallacy. First of all, he's using words, so it's going to be a fallacy, what he's pointing at.
Yeah, but you see then, I mean, that's a very good example of how he needs an ontology, right? The if words are only false because they're simply because they're words.
No, because they're in an electric environment, so there's new language that words can't get a hold of.
Okay, but don't go too fast because you know that the electric environment does not exclude the literary environment. It includes it.
Yes.
Right. So it's not as if words are only false or that there's only a new language. The new language somehow includes the old.
Yes.
And that the great trick is to think about that somehow.
Right.
Right. It's not. We can't just say the new language includes the old. End of story. give me my ticket to speak at a symposium in Florence, Italy.
Yeah,
that doesn't work.
Right. You know,
it works if you want to travel, but it doesn't work if you want to think about McLuhan.
Right. And you're explaining why. So people think in the public. Global theater iconography. McLuhan showed up late 60s, made some interesting statements, disappeared. And his books repeat themselves, later books if you happen to come across them. They're not recognizing the endless exploration that McLuhan was doing and the new discoveries he was making, ongoing right up till, I last spoke to him in April 20th, 1979, you know. It was just a few months later, he was gone. But he was, I went to those seminars in the late 70s, and he seemed to be pretty, not the way Marchand would say he was, Philip Marchand, like he was getting depressed and negative and that. No way. Constantly making new discoveries. And people didn't know that whether he made books or not, he was still energized by new discoveries, new pattern recognitions. That's the part of McLuhan that you're saying people miss. That's the egg on. That's the ongoing exploration. Regardless of what his
book is. Well, if somebody doesn't know what exploration means, and if they don't know what discovery means, and if they don't even know what thinking means, then of course all they're going to see in McLuhan is what they already know.
Yeah, right.
Right? I mean, the whole theme of the rear view mirror and how it is possible to experience either against it or outside of it is a huge thing for McLuhan. When he talks about logos, one of the main things he's talking about is the learning of language by a child. And the child cannot learn the first words that it learns to speak without stepping aside from the rearview mirror.
Yeah.
The child needs to go through the mirror of its previous experience and begin to reorient itself in an entirely new universe.
Is this what Lacan was trying to say but botched? You know, L-A-C-A-N, the French thinker on the mirror stage?
Oh, maybe. There's many people that I think one day I may read, but I've never read a line of Lacan.
Oh, okay.
So I can't speak about that.
Right, but it comes up as you, what you, the words you just said. Okay, so you were just explaining that the child, and maybe developed, say a couple more sentences about that. I interrupted with the Lacan.
Okay, well, he has a letter. I forget who the letter is to. I think it's in 1970, and I have a couple of posts about it in the blog.
Oh, Joe Keough? The letter to Joe Keough?
Well, of course I know who Joe Keough is, but I don't know that the letter was written to him. I think it wasn't. But the letter I'm talking about, he says that in the future, our experience is all of our experience is going to be like that of a child first learning language.
Oh, no, I don't. That's not the letter to Joe Keough I'm thinking of. No.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So, well, it's very interesting because it's what he's talking about there is how it is that humans can discover things. How is it that we can relate outside of our own limited experience to the real, right? And this is where epistemology and ontology come together.
Yeah.
How is it that something like science is possible? How is it that people are able to learn, to actually learn about how things work? And McLuhan's answer to that is that there is a interrelationship in which people always already exist, which allows contact with the other person, other thing.
Right. No, it's a really important statement. It might be in Catholic Humanism in 1954, where he explains how we could not perceive media, technological environments, unless they were part of us.
Yes. Uh-huh. And look at that. What you say there is very interesting in terms of what we were previously talking about.
Yeah.
If we say part of us, if somebody says, well, what we mean by us is what I meet when I walk out of your house and I talk to the various people on the street, that's the us. No. The us is a question.
Yeah.
Right? So if we say that that's part of us, that's only true if it's understood that there's nothing concrete, nothing well known about that word us. The word us is a huge, huge question, and what he's saying there makes sense only when we are able to drop what we think we know about us and open it up to probing.
Okay, so here's two thoughts. I had this a little while ago. Talking about the Winnipeg School of Communication, he has in Counterblast 1954 version about the lonely whistling of the trains on the prairies evoking the separateness of man, the eternal separateness. And he talks about that private man existed before tribal man. That would be, I assume, early Paleolithic man, some semi-caveman guys wandering around by themselves. They hadn't even begun to be socialized by speech. So you have this very Paleolithic scenario. He only mentions once in a speech in L.A. It's written up in Rolling Stone magazine in 1970, and about this condition before tribal men. And then he's talking about this lonely weirdness out in the prairies where, people could go for miles, I guess, and I've passed through there a few times, and not see anybody. Is McLuhan bringing a Winnipegian pigeon, whatever it is, huge, vast spaces? Because he says the European can't understand the electric environment, the new global theater, because their sense of space is too tiny with their nice little cozy cities and towns, feudal designs. The vast spaces of electronic situations is only understood in America and maybe only in the prairies. What do you think of that idea, if you want to go back to the Winnipeg sensibility?
Well, that makes the Winnipeg sensibility very concrete, right? You walk out of Winnipeg or you walk out of Regina,
right?
Where I was born, and you get onto the prairie, and then you experience this. So I see things like that as McLuhan using words, because that's the only way I can talk to you.
Right.
I don't see it as any way to get a handle on what he's talking about. You always, in order to understand what McLuhan's talking about, you have to enter that vast empty space, which is first and foremost between what we used to know 1 second ago and what we're trying to know 1 second hence.
Right. Now,
right?
I think, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, keep going.
No. Well, I mean, we're coming back to what we're always talking about. McLuhan is not somebody who thinks that there is anything literal, anything figurative, anything that is obvious that can tell us what we need to know. Instead, it is the questionability of things, it's the gap between what we think we know and what we need to know that needs to be exposed and explored.
Yeah, now
until,
you're... Go ahead. No, keep going.
No. I would prefer to go back and forth a little bit more. Some of the stuff I'm saying is boring even to me.
Why is it boring? Not boring.
Well,
I'm trying to get what you're meaning. So, but here's my response is that McLuhan one night in a seminar Monday night thing, somebody said, well, that's just a half-truth. And McLuhan says, well, a half-truth is a lot of truth for most people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And look at, I mean, and that sort of... that has many different levels, right? First off, it's not as if human beings ever have the whole truth. So the very big question that's involved in that is, if we only have half-truths, then how do we actually know anything? Right? So that's the epistemology ontology thing.
Yes.
Right? Then one of the really great things about McLuhan, in my estimation, because he had this great sense of humor, so that he could take things that were very, very deep, very, very problematic, and enjoy them as humor, as jokes.
Yes. Well, okay, so this, a couple impressions of what you're saying. Your emphasis on the gap in depth in your blog is really important, and no one else has done it. I've mentioned a little bit, but you've done the work. You've laid out the quotes. And you're making a point, a half-truth about McLuhan that has been never acknowledged, basically. I've been making, with my expertise, the other half-truth. I've been making sweeping statements which some people might think are Manipian satire like they think McLuhan was doing. And I was interested in your commentary on the problem of Manipian satire as a tag for McLuhan. But that's another topic. So the vast statements I make... like I come up with the Android meme and the five bodies and these things, is like the other half. We actually do very different approaches to this thing, to the McLuhan phenomenon. And they're complementary. I think they're different, but they're both based on the rare fact that we've read a lot of McLuhan, thought a lot about him. That's what's good about this. And your point about the gap and the undecidability of half of everything or most of everything, when you start looking at humans... how do they even work with half-truth? That leads to almost an image of McLuhan as a dramatist, as a playwright. And he's showing the odd, he said the manners of life. He does a satire on the manners. He calls it a new kind of science fiction. The humor or satirical part of McLuhan comes out of your perception. The programming of the technocrat part of McLuhan comes out of mine. But my kind of statements, but mine are more obviously silly or absurd than yours. You have a grounding in philosophy. You know what I mean? There's a crossing over, flipping here. And I start off at one point and then over in yours, and you start off at another point and then on the other side, crossing over. because you, I was just starting to say, think about, hey, McLuhan, you're talking about McLuhan as a novelist. See, and then you said, I'm thinking that, and then you say sense of humor. And so you're saying the same thing I was about to say. There's a dramatic, the drama of cognition is Marshall as a playwright. And Baudrillard called McLuhan a musician. I think that's a great statement.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the Gutenberg arts McLuhan is including.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, I think you know that I try to relate this to his mother's work.
Which is
and,
good, yeah.
The Winnipeg School of Communication is a school that grows out of the insight that nobody says anything in neutral fashion. Everybody says something from some point of view, with some object in mind, with some view of the other person that is being said to. And so when Mitchell is a novelist and a playwright, and when Goffman is interested as a sociologist in the drama of exchange, this is closely related to what McLuhan was doing, and all of them are thinking about the really deep problems that are implicated here. Because, I mean, if things are only drama, do they amount to anything? And if they're only drama, how do we have science and mathematics? And if they're only drama, how does the child first begin to relate to the mother and the father and the family and so on, right? There's a whole series of embedded problems here that this school thought about within a tradition stretching back thousands of years that has also thought about it.
Right. Well, what is it that you meant citing the Winnipeg style of communication? Say that better. What do they do out there?
Well, I mean, I've lived in Winnipeg, and I know all kinds of people there. I think it's generally true of Western Canada that, our view of the world and our humor often turns on the knowledge that people are coming from somewhere, that people are motivated not only to say what they're saying, but how they're saying it.
Why is that particular? What causes that to happen in Winnipeg?
Maybe the clash of cultures.
Oh, okay.
Winnipeg has a big population of Jews that have added there's a different flavor in Winnipeg on account of its Jewish population, which is it probably has the highest percentage of Jews of any city in Canada. It's similar to the proportion of Jews in English-speaking Montreal, I would say.
I see, yeah.
And in both places, that's been an ingredient that has led to a humor and to insight that you don't necessarily get in a more homogeneous place.
Right. Is the English-speaking part of Montreal, is that Outremont? Are you thinking of Outremont?
Well, Westmount.
Oh, Westmount. Okay, not Outremont. All right. I've had experiences in Outremont with
uh-huh.
Jewish people, so I thought maybe that's what you were referring to. It's Westmount where there's a heavy...
No, well, all I was referring to is that traditionally the Jews in Montreal have been part of the English-speaking population as opposed to the total population.
Oh, okay.
And so then I was comparing that... the English-speaking population of Montreal, so less than half, and then the Jewish portion of that, I was comparing that to the similar situation in Winnipeg.
Okay. 2 points. If people don't know who Irving Goffman is. He's a big deal because one time in the 80s at CKLN, a listener of mine came to me to talk about something else. And all of a sudden, this was a woman. She says, "Well, that's Goffman, blah, blah, blah." I go, "Goffman, who's he?" And she goes, "You don't know who Goffman is?" It was the same way I would be with people. "You don't know who McLuhan is?" And I had no clue who he was, but this would be a student in the 80s. He was a big deal, I guess, in the 80s, right? People studied.
Absolutely. And yeah. still is a pretty big deal.
Yeah. What is his basic – has he got a basic idea?
Well, sure. I mean, he's an interactionist. He's a – Goffman had a – well, first, I'll just give you a little bit of information that will tie it into McLuhan a bit.
Yeah.
Goffman's sister is now dead, Frances Bay. She was an actress and appeared in Seinfeld and in a whole bunch of things, so that people, if they were to see Goffman's sister, they would know who she is. She's a familiar actress from movies and television. And his mother was active in Little Theater in Manitoba. So right away you have a parallel with McLuhan.
Yes.
And that you have people that are very much influenced towards sort of an understanding of life as theater because their life was theater, right?
Yes.
So, and W.O. Mitchell, another one of the second generation of the Winnipeg School, his father was a reader, an impersonator, just like McLuhan's mother.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
So I would say that often Western humor turns on the idea of where you're coming from, but that is particularly true for people involved in the theater where they have to consciously
put on
adopt points of view.
They got to put on.
Exactly.
Yeah, Winnipeg, the capital of the put on.
Yeah, that's more or less what I'm, a thesis that I'm trying to articulate.
Yeah, it's like, okay, I'll take some of my stereotypes about Winnipeg. Important city, but not part of Ontario. Isolated, but important because it goes down Highway 59 or something, goes down there into key middle American states, right? Route 59, I think it is.
Winnipeg is on an axis with Minneapolis, and there's always been, a big exchange between Winnipeg and the South, because to the west you have only underpopulated prairies and then the mountains, and to the east you have northern and western Ontario, which is not suited for transportation.
Yeah.
And so Winnipeg has always been a place that it was Canadian. It had early Canadian settlements, and it had an important function within Canadian distribution of goods. But on the other hand, it was difficult to get to from Canada and very easy to get to from the United States.
It's
sort of crazy pattern.
It's like what McLuhan defined Canada. It's a borderline case. It's like Nowhereville, but very active over in that world and would feel alienated because Ontario doesn't recognize them because there's a big gap between Ontario geophysically and Winnipeg. So
in the days that we're talking about, Winnipeg was the third largest city in Canada.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Or bigger than Vancouver.
Right. Okay. Now, what's interesting about the school here is it's not just sociologists or psychologists. You got novelists. You could probably have a couple of hockey players in there. That's what McLuhan would... when they talk about the Toronto School of Communication and discuss, you know, Havelock, Grant, and Havelock, Innes, and McLuhan, they should include Gordie Howe or something. They, in McLuhan's terms, it's not just an academic fucking school, right? It would include poets, singers, and other people that the present academic discipline doesn't do. They're just looking at writers or something.
Yeah, well, Glenn Gould would,
yes.
I think, is included by some people.
Yeah.
And then there's artists like Harold Town. And,
yeah.
So, I mean, but we need to remember that these characterizations, like Winnipeg School of Communications, Toronto School of Communications, et cetera, they're heuristic. There are things that may be interesting to talk about. It may give birth to insight, but we're not establishing, you know, chemical elements here or something. There's nothing that's sort of rule governed about who can be included or who not.
Yeah, it is for academia to organize their materials for students.
Yeah.
It's,
or to organize their argument for fame.
Yeah,
promotion, for tenure. Yeah.
Okay, so...
One thing that actually I came to think about just a few minutes ago, because you mentioned five bodies.
Yes.
John O'Neill in Toronto is a guy that I knew fairly well at one point and that I like a lot. Great guy. He had a book called Five Bodies.
Yes, I'm aware of it. I'm aware of the book.
Yeah. So, but what influence did that have?
No.
I
didn't know of it when I coined the five words, the five bodies.
Oh, I see.
It has nothing. And I looked at it. I don't have a copy. I have one of his other books, but I looked at it in a bookstore. And I said, nah, that's nowhere near what I'm talking about. So, but maybe people that keep bringing it up, maybe I'll go take another look at it. And because that was way back in the late 80s or early 90s I looked at it. But I have a pretty eccentric layout of what the five bodies are. I don't think academia would hear it. And so I don't think O'Neill. It's Neil or O'Neill? O'Neill, isn't it?
O'Neill.
Yeah. I used to talk about him with Zingroni. Frank Zingroni knew him well. And
they were both at York.
Yes. Okay, another point. Some of the critics of McLuhan, the early critics in like the Pro and Con book, they said McLuhan had no sense of drama. Now that is what we're pointing out and what you're pointing out. He had a great sense of drama on a deeper level than the journalists of the day could understand. Do you know what I'm saying? I think that McLuhan was one of the greatest actors of our time because he acted on a bigger scale than Jack Nicholson, who just did puny movies. You know what I mean? McLuhan put on
you
more.
I can understand what you're saying, sure.
Yeah.
That ties with my idea that if we're gonna treat him seriously, we have to treat him within a tradition that goes back thousands of years and that deals with very deep questions.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's more or less what you're saying.
Yes. But it also includes the other arts. It includes the quadrivium. Math, music, astronomy, and geometry, especially music. You know, someone told, I don't know if it was Ion, it just came out recently that McLuhan's favorite medium was radio. And I don't think we perceive it that way, that he was a writer and a talker, and he was trying to be a Broadway playwright. But radio was his favorite medium. That might indicate Winnipegian acoustic sensibility there. Anyways, just
maybe certainly in Winnipeg. I mean, he built a radio, if I remember.
Yes. Yeah.
Reading somewhere a crystal set.
Yeah.
And when he was growing up, there was no television, so that radio was the thing that. He probably had memories of between the time he was, you know, 12 and 25, listening to music and World Series and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah. Okay, so the famous, who's the famous Canadian composer? He did Tuning the Sky, Murray somebody. forget his name right at the moment. Murray somebody. McCone talks about him in Take Today in different places. I went to a lecture he gave a few years ago, and he, when he sat in McLuhan's class, 1950-51, McLuhan would sit in the middle, and the students would be in a circle around him. And so he was in this swirling chair, so he could move around performing. He would say to Murray and those that listened that Finnegan's Wake was not a book, it was a radio program. I've noticed you doing some pretty good exegesis of the last page of Finnegan's Wake. Are you pretty well versed on Finnegan's Wake, or are you just beginning?
No, not. That's something else that I sort of have. Something else that I really need to do, but I can't claim any expertise in the text at all.
Well, you did pretty good in the little bit you did on the last page, but. You know, Finney's Wake's a radio program. I was going to ask, do you see that Finney's Wake is an early attempt, that is a deep philosophical aspiration of the probing and paradoxes of communication or the agon of communication that McLuhan was developing? Do you know enough about the
sure.
Wake to see that?
No, I think that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. As soon as you begin to think about time as plural, which is... When Finnegan's Wake opens, it immediately gives a panorama of time.
Right.
Right? And that panorama of time is not linear. It's not just past. It's also now.
Yes.
And so a problem is posed as to what is going on here. In the Winnipeg sense, we have to ask who is speaking continually.
Yes.
In Finnegan's Wake, right?
Yeah.
What are all these different voices? So,
is your dog protesting something?
Well, we've got one dog that doesn't like the mailman. He may be dealing with that. I'm not sure.
Okay, so here's a couple of. Particular questions. You have here a cosmic invisible architecture of the human dark. I think you're quoting page 13 of Counterblast, 1969 version. And then you say, interesting that the word clap appears in these two contexts. I couldn't find the word clap in that sentence or paragraph. What are you referring to there?
Oh, I don't know. I would have to look that up.
Okay.
Have you got the post there, or do you just have a?
I just have a note. I don't know which where it was. I didn't note the essay it's in or a short blog. So I'll have to. I can maybe find that, but I'll do it again. You have a quote: a cosmic invisible architecture of the human dark, and then you say, interesting that the word clap, and that's in quote, appears in these two contexts. So that doesn't, you don't know what I'm referring to immediately. You have to find it.
I know what page you're talking about in Counterblast, and I know that by clap, one of which has many, many, many meanings, of course,
yeah.
But one of them has to have to do with lightning. And what the other one was that I had in mind, I would have to check the post.
Oh, I see. Okay. So yeah, if you think of it as a lightning clap, that makes sense. A cosmic invisible architecture of the human dark. It's sort of like a lightning flash.
Uh-huh.
Even though it says invisible. Okay. So I hadn't thought of that meaning. All right. Then you have another point. You have Joyce's essay on the press.
Mm-hmm.
What's it called? Mallarmé and Something in the Press. You have a date, 1954. It should be 1953, I'm pretty sure.
Okay, I'll check that out.
Yeah, check that. And then, let's see. I have contemporary history.